Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Right. Welcome to another Word in Your Ear. And we're joined by wearing a splendid pair of headphones that look as if they last saw service on a BOAC pilot going across the Atlantic. Which wouldn't be surprising at all. Tony Fletcher. Hello, Tony.
Great to see you.
Thank you for that great introduction. I'm quite proud of them. They're quite new, actually. Thank you for the compliment. My last pair lasted about 15 years.
Well, headphones have sort of they've made a virtue of being small, and then they've made a virtue of being big again, haven't they? You know, they're kind of they're a fashion item nowadays as much as anything else. Anyway, I'm not criticized at all. Tony, lovely.
Tony? You're somewhere. Is it near Woodstock? We talked to you before, and I think it's near Woodstock. It's East Coast.
Yeah, it is. It is absolutely. I'm in Kingston, New York, original state capital of New York. The British burned it down during the Revolution, though some of the stone buildings survived. So there is a bit of a British look to it. It's the gateway to the Catskills, only about 15 minutes from the famous village of Woodstock, if not the actual festival of Woodstock, and just about 100 miles north of New York City.
Okay.
Out of
there, you've managed to produce a very English product, I think.
Very English.
None more English.
None more English. When I received it, I thought, well, this is like the Beano Christmas annual. Is that what you were seeking, wasn't it?
That was 100% what I was seeking. I kept saying to the publishers, what I really want to do with this is have it feel like one of those Christmas annuals, and Beano is perfect. Yeah. I mean, if that's genuinely what you got from it, that's it. I can move on to the next project.
Everything's been achieved.
It's not glossy. Well, it's got a glossy cover, but, you know, inside it's kind of, it's matte, isn't it, really? And it's got the feeling of the original fanzine, isn't it? I mean, you presumably sought to get the same kind of paper, did you?
I got to give credit to the publishers on that, because I actually wasn't entirely sure what paper we were going to use. The one thing I'll say about it that was kind of hilarious is, on PDF, it looked like so shiny and crystal clear. And of course, as anybody uses a PDF knows, you can blow them up and blow them up and blow them up. And they still look perfect. And when I got the book, I was like, yeah, good old fanzine days. Got to get the glasses out.
It is. It's so funny. The first thing that struck me was that in those days, fanzines always had a lot of underprinting, didn't they? Yeah. So you'd have the text, and underneath you'd have the picture of Paul McCartney, which always made it incredibly difficult to read. Very nostalgic.
Infamous. I know.
We'll come to that. We're better for the benefit of anybody who can't see this. So just explain what this is we're talking about. This is the best of jamming. Selections and stories from the fanzine that grew up 1977 to 1986, put together by Tony Fletcher, forward by Billy Bragg. But Tony, this was very much your baby, and you've been on the past in our podcast talking about this, haven't you? You started this when you were at school, didn't you?
I did start it at school at the age of 13 in South London, which I really put down to more the fact that it was just it was the autumn of 1977. So I put it down more to the fact that things were happening rather than just that I started something at that such a young age. But it did grow. And I, you know, after a year of doing it at school, I decided that I actually quite liked doing this school fanzine and I wanted to grow it. I had no particular plan or idea. I guess I probably had a little bit of ambition and you know, wherefore. But it lasted a decade. It grew into a national magazine, like so many bands that we all talk about. Record labels, you know, it ends up commerce gets in the way of the creativity. And after a decade, it kind of, you know, I knocked it on the head, it collapsed, whatever you want to say about it. But all these years down the line, I'm so thrilled to put a book together because it's a journey. Yeah.
We'll get to all that.
Well, I'll tell you, I couldn't help feeling very envious. I thought, I wish I had a book like this of every magazine I've ever been involved with. You know, because I have kind of bound volumes and so forth of certain things. But, you know, but this is just a wonderful kind of quick tour. Well, it is quite detailed, really. But, you know, it's, as you say, 10 years summarized in there. And I'm sure for many people who've lost their original copies or they've surrendered to mildew or whatever, this is a brilliant way to replace them, isn't it? It's an extraordinary thing.
But take us back to when you launched it, because, you were 13, and in the intro, it's fantastic. You talk about being backstage at Thin Lizzy concerts at the Hammersmith Odeon, so you were kind of really involved from a very early age. What were you were you reading the music press and fanzines at the time? And,
and
was this a reaction against them or what?
No, not at all. It wasn't a reaction against, particularly against the music papers, because the inspiration was actually a Centre Page Spread in Sounds written by John Savage, of all people, about fanzines. And we don't always associate John Savage with that kind of punk, so much of that. But I mean, he wrote this thing about fanzines. There were three or four of us in my class at school.
I remember it.
You do remember that piece?
Yes, I do,
Good, good. Well, I actually still have it. Funny enough, I found it when I was preparing this book, and we use it as an underlay early on in the book. There were three or four of us at school that were really, really, really into music, more so than others. And actually, the friend that I asked to start the fanzine with me, who I'm still really close friends with, he said no for reasons he can't quite compute all these years down the line. And he suggested I ask the other kid who was a hard rock fan whose dad was very high up in the main sort of security company at the time. And actually, it was the friend who said no who went backstage at the Thin Lizzy show. I didn't get to see Thin Lizzy, but it did mean that there were a few of us that were really music mad. And this other kid, Lawrence Weaver, had access to, I guess, through his dad to get into concerts.
Oh, wrongly, yes. Mm.
But my friend John Matthews, and I'll give him a credit because he's the one who wrote that piece in the front of the magazine about being backstage with Thin Lizzy. You know, I'll give him credit because he's maintained incredibly eclectic music taste, but we laugh about it. I asked him after reading this copy of Sounds during the math lesson, hey, John, you want to start one of these fanzines with me? He went, nah, not really. You should ask Lawrence. And so I did. And so we ended up for the first few issues with a so-called fanzine that was sort of partly about the Jam and partly about Rush.
Yeah, it is. It says on the cover, it says the story of Led Zeppelin or something. And there's a little gossip and news thing called Spills, 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 which is partly about Nazareth and ELO and partly about the Pistols and the Stranglers. So you were kind of looking for your identity at that stage, weren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we all want to kind of be able to rewrite our past as being, we were all perfectly formed by some epiphany.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I did have an epiphany in 1977, but it kind of took a while. And I I'm quite glad about that, because all these years down the line, I recognize that some of the music I liked sort of pre and around punk was great, and some of it was prog rubbish. And I'm at least glad that I was exposed to a lot of that before really kind of coming down into that post-punk new wave world that I was very fortunate to be so in the midst of.
Yeah.
So what was the idea of the book? I mean, you're not reproducing all of it, are you? But
no, not at all.
Right. Okay. So what was your kind of selection criteria as to what got included and what didn't?
Well, the criteria, the process, if I can use that word, was incredibly hard. And you've both edited magazines. And I started off with this wish list that took me kind of weeks to put together, sent it to the editor. And they said something like, well, that's 450 pages. And we priced out for 224. So cut 50%. Kind of started from there and worked our way down the line. The editor was very helpful about saying, let's try and get, a sports article in there and a political and an artist. And I thought that was really important because I've made sure in this book that we've got features about Aswad, about the rise of the British MC, about Run DMC, some African music, because it would be too easy to just fill this with the bands that people associate.
Oh, yeah, there's an anti-fox hunting piece. And
there's a profile of
George Best. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I really wanted to get those pieces in. But it was a process. And then what we ended up deciding to do was we would reprint certain stories more or less full size, and so that hopefully people can read them despite the original layout. And then we would reprint additional pages more for the visual impact.
Right.
So there's a lot of stuff I don't actually expect people to be able to read. It's really about the visual impact of those particular pieces. And then so much fun reaching out to former contributors, people I hadn't been in touch with since the end of the magazine, and tracking some people down and getting some contributions from them all over again. And the whole thing just felt like being immersed back in the process of editing the magazine because, you know, we were late to the printers and there was too much copy and I was correcting the same people's copy I used to correct 35 years ago.
So did you enjoyed it, did you? I mean, because do you miss editing something? Because Mark and I talk about this all the time, because we, you know, you probably get stopped by old jamming readers say, oh, why do you start it all over again just for me kind of thing? And I always think, no, I don't want to do any of this again.
I've got 3 o'clock the morning, years of my life doing print, banging out captions. You probably feel differently.
No, I honestly don't miss the monthly deadlines. You probably, I think you were involved in magazines that were maybe more frequent than that. I don't miss that at all. There were too many all-nighters. But all of us in this very medium we're in here are doing podcasts. And, yeah, you know, editing a podcast is almost like a modern way of doing that. So I do still pull the occasional later night than I would like to, trimming down a podcast. Doing this book was enormous fun. I did push it a little close to the print deadline. I did laugh about the fact that I was, you know, still dealing with contributors who would go sort of missing for a few days while
this
I was desperate to get their approval.
This is what they do. It doesn't matter how professional or how amateur they are, they just disappear.
Yeah. All of that said, it was lovely, and especially to reconnect with people and more than anything to learn from a number of people who wrote for the magazine, probably for very little pay, how fondly they felt towards it. I hadn't actually anticipated it being on that level. I thought this was a little more self-serving, sort of I wanted to do this.
Well, presumably also they would love having this book, weren't they? You know, if you've written for Jammin' and your piece is in there, you put it on show your children or whatever. This is what I did in the war or something.
Yes,
you know? To be able to show them in print is the kind of key thing. I love the bits you've added from the notebooks. Can I refer you to page 109?
Reminds me of one of the buses from Brixton down to Streatham.
You've got a page called From the Notebooks, where somehow you've reproduced the finance report.
That's brilliant. With the 11,000, I made a note of that too. It's fantastic because the print bill is 1,100 quid, I think. Yeah, and you also keep a record of every single, the number of copies that go to each shop.
Absolutely.
And then the number of copies go to each individual. So you've got kind of, you know, Kate from, Kate from Norwich has got 50 copies to sell.
That's right.
It's brilliant. So when it's £1,100, did you ever make any money out of it? I mean, I'm assuming it must have made a profit at some stage.
Yeah, well, looking at it, around that period, I'm trying to see, the account got settled with Better Badges. So
Better Badges, of course.
They were the printers, Jolly. And actually, I saw Jolly just a few weeks ago. He lives in New York. And I went up and hand-delivered Jolly his copy because he was...
So what are you saying? Better Badges printed it?
Yeah, Better Badges printed from issues 7 to 12.
Oh, really?
And I always give credit to Jolly. I think it was largely circumstantial, but fate, you know, kind of intervened. And I'm not sure if Jamming would have had a future after issue 6, because anybody who's done a fanzine will tell you the printing is it just was destroying me trying to find a good printer. And I'd had been through 2 printers in 2 issues, and I was enormously struggling. And I went up to see Jolly to hassle him for an advert so that I could help meet a printing bill. And he told me, I'm just getting hold of a printer to print more badges. And I've got this camera that I'm going to do my own work. And do you want to be a guinea pig? And you can do it for cost.
And of course, he was putting a lot of business printers way as well, wasn't he, with his badges, was he?
So he was. And he was doing a lot of badges himself and he wanted to expand. And so he printed Jamming at cost. And after that, I sent other fanzines his way, where he could charge them, you know, a markup. And so there was this period where people talked about a, quote, Better Badges fanzine. There was a certain look that became a little generic. But the period that Jamming really built and was a fanzine through and through, but it built from sort of almost black and white to a sort of gatefold A3 magazine. Those half dozen issues were all done at Better Badges.
Right. And now just one further thing on your accounts. I was delighted you got owed to mum £350 paid back.
I know that.
So you did your mum advanced you £350.
Well, I better look at this. Did she? That sounds very generous. where is that? I'm assuming it's right there. But
in the middle of page 109.
Owed to mum £350. Yeah. God, she was great. She used to come up to Better Badges and like pick up, you know, 1,000 fanzines that I would then staple and collate on my bedroom floor. You know, they still have fond memories of her. This sort of, you know, she was a school teacher, so she wasn't immune.
That's
to,
a lot of money.
Oh, so she knew how to organize things.
Well, I think she also wasn't completely thrown out by being in sort of crazy places like Rough Trade or Better Badges. But I did have a little kind of cottage industry going in the bedroom when I used to have to collate and staple them, you know, because it was cheaper to do it yourself. And I'd get my school friends around. I had a whole production line of how we would do it. And we just put on singles, records, and, you know, have fun evenings. Kept us off the streets, I guess.
So you did it for 10 years and you said you kind of, I don't know, lost interest or whatever. But 10 years in fanzine life is a long time, isn't it?
Yeah.
You clearly had kind of staying power that lots of other people didn't. And lots of other people must have done three and then thought, oh, yeah, I'll move on to something else. I'll go to college, whatever. You clearly just, you had that right stuff, didn't you, to do this?
Yeah, I mean, that's for other people to say. I guess I did it. Well, you know, you and I appreciate that. I guess I did enjoy it for long enough that I wanted to do it. And jamming seemed to sort of fulfill some kind of role in the music world. And I guess what we're all looking for, because we don't, you know, we don't all plan these lives. You know, it's not like somebody who really says, I am going to become, you know, a nuclear physicist or even indeed a doctor, which is such an honorable profession, and sets off down that path. If you're doing a fanzine and it's building and then more and more contributors want to write to you and more bands say, you know, here's a record, and it's easier access to the bands that you did want to interview, and you're enjoying being in the midst of a scene, then you stick at it. You know, it's an age-old thing. Is it fun, despite the hard work, despite the deadlines, despite the financial crush? And you were asking if it made money. I mean, yes, I paid jolly back through most of that period, but I think once we actually went commercial, it never made money. So I should have kept it at that level, probably.
How easy was it? There's a fantastic letter from Paul Weller. This is when you were 14. Saying, yes, come to Rack Studios where I'm recording. I'd love you to hear the new album. Here's the telephone number. Give me a ring. You know, let's sort out an interview. And you must have been thinking at that point, I can't believe it's as easy as that. That must have been a real surprise. And then the next issue, I think you get Pete Townsend, and two issues later, Paul McCartney. I mean, how easy was it setting that up? And was it partly because they didn't want to do the music press? And this was actually a wonderful, safe place where they weren't going to get criticised.
Yeah, we've been talking about that a little bit with doing the book. And I think the answer is that, yes, they did enjoy doing fanzines. And I think that most people, you know, did Pete Townsend. I met Keith Moon right before he died. If you're a little kid and you're getting in touch with these people, I think they have something wrong with them to just like completely ignore you. But that would maybe be more in person. For somebody like Weller to write back, it was such a surprise. You know, that summer after doing a school fanzine, which it was printed at school, it felt like very much like a school fanzine. I figured, well, I want interviews, so let me write to a bunch of people. And the Weller wrote back literally within a few days. And I couldn't believe that letter either. It was, and I also have to say that the Jammer were already my favorite group. I wasn't like casting my net so far that like, oh, I'll settle for the Jam. This was my favorite band, despite the fact their second album had kind of tanked. And I probably wrote to Paul just as David Watts' A-Bomb in Wardour Street was charting. But other than that, they had been widely considered by the music press to be completely spent, you know, just another band that had too much too soon. But they were my favorite band. I'd already seen them two or three times at the age of 14. And so to get that letter back completely shocked me. I mean, the number, funny, of course, wasn't his. It was his family number. He was living up in London. But I actually kind of guessed as much. And I spoke to his mum.
No, it's still pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I went up. Yeah, yeah, it's number. Amazing. Yeah.
So what? Tell us about the layout and production of jamming and how you went about things. But were you doing it single-handed, or was there a designer or anything like that?
There are various kind of itinerations, if that's the right word, of jamming. A lot of the early issues were done with somebody I was also in a band with, Jeff Carrigan, and he had a few design skills. He did go on to London College of Printing, I recall, and he helped out a lot. His dad helped us get the printer for that number 5, which is the one with the Weller interview we just mentioned. And then we did a lot of it in my bedroom. Do you remember, it still exists, I think, cow gum?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good grief.
I can smell it now.
Yeah. I don't believe it's good for you.
Oh, you say it's certainly not. None of that stuff.
Almost got some here, isn't it? It's pretty much that, isn't it?
Yeah. I also don't believe that Tippex is good for you. And I do know that there are people who would, you know, like make a point of sniffing Tippex. And no. I also don't believe that spray paint is good for you. But
spray mount.
Spray mount.
No, actual spray paint. Spray mount's not good for you either.
Yeah, but spray mount wouldn't be good for you.
And spray paint isn't. But for a while there, I'm amazed I've got brain cells left. My bedroom was full of cow gum, Tippex, and we actually hand sprayed issue 5 through a stencil in my bedroom, going through several cans of spray paint. While hallucinating that I was actually doing something of merit.
See, I remember these days so well, because even Smash Hits, done for a kind of professional publisher in those days, pre-desktop publishing, was done the same way. You know,
it was
cutouts, it was letter set. From the shop down the corner.
Pictures
and so forth.
Projected onto walls.
Yeah, and Steve Bush, the art director, used to regularly just get down underneath his desk, I remember, with a big piece of paper. And then you'd hear this hissing of spray mount, you know, as he fixed something. And nobody for a second ever said, is this a bit dangerous?
Should we
Did
be
anybody
this?
Ever say
And you'd
that?
Walk around all afternoon picking very valuable transparencies off the bottom of your shoes.
Stuck to the bottom of your shoes. It was a sticky business, wasn't it?
It really was.
It was classic cut and paste. It wasn't Command C, Command V. It was like, here's a transcript. Oh, I allocated 4 pages. Yes. It's 5 pages long. Cut, paste, cut. Paste.
And I haven't got room for the photograph and the type, so we'll put one on top of the other.
Yeah, of course, obviously. Yeah. And then you send it to the printers and they can't figure out how to half-tone it, so they half-tone the entire page so you get the page back in grey. Yeah, that's where...
And it's
that's
illegible.
Yeah, that's where Jolly really, really came in handy. On the design front, obviously, as we're recounting, the fanzine grew into a magazine. But again, I think that golden period, what I look back on as a kind of golden period, Robin Richards, who passed away, he was a great designer. And he came up with the logo that's on the front of the book, the kind of Roy Lichtenstein style logo.
Right.
And he helped design... some front covers that I think really propelled us forward. He was a t-shirt designer by trade. So he brought this very visual t-shirt ethic to it. He had no idea how to lay out a magazine either. The printers were just like, what is this we're working from? Because he was used to silk screening.
Well, Steve Bush, who was the art director of Smash Hits, and the absolutely key person in Smash Hits, same background, t-shirts. He used t-shirts and badges is what his background was. He'd never designed.
He'd never done a magazine before he joined.
And the thing I was going to say that actually a further parallel with Smash Hits, talking about the logo, is you varied the logo quite a bit, didn't you?
It ends up as just J, isn't it? Just the letter J, isn't that right?
I think that's the point at which you're kind of running out of.
I don't want to suggest that was a bad idea.
Is that hurtful?
No.
Don't want to intrude upon private grief, but we know what it's like in the world of magazines.
We do.
Somebody always says, oh, do you think it'd be easy if we made a single letter? Is that what happened?
I think it is. So I feel very strange about the last
because you can read it when it's racked on shelves, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, actually, visually, it works. I guess had it succeeded and carried on at that point, it would have been known as J Magazine, which, you know, whatever.
Because also you've got the logo. You've got the logo on its side here. I mean, this is only what Smash Hits did round about the same time. And, you know, because people were, even Smash Hits, very commercial magazine, were literally making up the rules as we went along. Nobody would change the logo of anything nowadays.
No. We change it routinely. We change it every 18 months or something. Just let's change the logo. Which
you
is crazy.
So would do it without telling anybody.
Madness. Never consulted the publisher. I know.
So I've got to ask you now. I'm going to flip the script. Were your designers the kind that when we're talking about cut and paste, and when I moved along and it was at least we got typesetting back and it was like it's still three lines too long. So your designer would just go fix it and cut off the last three lines.
Well, that certainly happened at the NME. I can remember people going along just snipping and then just putting a full stop in.
Cut from the bottom. Yeah. But in the NME, fair enough, they came from a newspaper culture where all the important stuff's in the first few paragraphs, and so it doesn't matter what's down at the bottom. Smash Hits was different.
Yeah, it's all in all a corker.
Yes. That's it. You couldn't really do that. Talk about this period where you had to say, all right, we can't go any further with it as a fanzine. It's got to be a proper magazine. So we're going to... glossier paper and
then it's sold in shops rather than record shops, isn't it?
Is that basically what you were doing?
Essentially, that's what happened. It had always got into some shops. I mean, certainly it was always in like things like Virgin Megastores. And then there were these two issues that are what I call the McCartney issues. I was running a record label at the time with Paul Weller, and jamming became literally an annual. I mean, we're joking at the start that this looks like an annual. I was so busy with this later, I just had no time in my life. So actually, there were these two excellent issues that were probably a little out of date by the time they came out, but they were great, both designed to a large degree by Robin Richards. The label closed when Paul Weller moved on with the Jam, you know, broke up the Jam, etc. And I was like, well, I better get back to that fanzine. But I similarly just felt, well, at the same time, given what's happened with the McCartney interviews, etc., time to really step it up. I went to a distributor called Seymour Press. I had a perfectly good relationship with down in Brixton, and they agreed to take it. And we became a bi-monthly, meaning came out every 2 months as of September 1983. And then a year later, they pushed me, and I should have been strong enough to say no. They pushed me and said, you know, bi-monthlies don't work. No, there aren't any. You know, go monthly. But going monthly was a recipe.
Because people just forget about you.
I get that. You know, they didn't forget about it when I had an annual fanzine, because they'd write to me and say, hey, I sent you £4 2 years ago.
Oh, but that's such
for six issues and you forgot for 2 years. Where's my money? Where's my magazine?
If it was selling in the shops, did that mean that you were aware of which covers sold, which bands sold? Was that because, I mean, that... I think all editors are haunted by. I'm haunted by the disaster of Dido on the cover of Word. You know, can you remember what the big sellers were?
I think I can. I mean, you would imagine it would be, you know, people like Morrissey, which it was, and U2, and I'm looking at them here, Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a point that we did a collage at the end of 1 year, and it didn't seem to affect it too much. I think hopefully you've got people going, you know, is the new jamming in stock? And they buy it. When I look at these covers, I mean, my regret, but I think this comes from coming out every 2 months, every month, and not being able to take the risks of a weekly. You know, every face on every cover is white. And every face on every cover, with the exception of two people that I can see here, is male.
Yeah,
and those two people are also not even solo artists.
Yes, the Cocteau Twins, and
Talking Heads. I think, you know, Tina Weymouth.
That's interesting. Yeah. There's a big debate about Talking Heads. You sort of said that you were agonised by the idea of having an American group on the cover. So was that a big cultural issue?
I think it was. I think we felt very, very British, which, by the way, I'm not particularly proud of, nor necessarily embarrassed by, but I think we did. We wrote a lot about the Husker Du's, about REM. We were in there from day one, from absolutely day one. I fell in love with REM. I think that we felt like a bit of a risk putting those people on the cover. And the cover is really, it's such a bind. We just did daft covers, though. I'm looking, we put Mike Scott on the cover with the Waterboys, and he deserved it. And we've got a picture of him hiding his face. And it just looks like a black cover. I mean, you know, if we were trying to like put, you know, marketable front covers. We weren't very good at that. I think the best we ever did was the photographer Russell Young did a great session with Morrissey that's been widely seen in the years since. Yeah. And that cover was probably really successful. But we were just, we were still amateur almost till the very, very end, almost.
It's very, very, very difficult to turn pro, isn't it, with these things? Really difficult. I mean, it's you're mirroring the same difficulties of the band, really. You know, that you,
yeah, you are.
Know, you know, when you, you know, because once you're monthly and once you're into WH Smiths and so you have to, and it's the same applies with the records. You have to compete with the set that you're in. You know, yeah. you no longer define your own terms. You know, you're alongside the Smash Hits, the Face, whatever else it is. And so if you're not glossy, you know, you suffer, really, all that kind of thing. It's just very, very, very hard.
And also some of your character was probably lost by that, actually. The magazine's character was as a kind of, as a fanzine, really. That was what kind of, you know, that's what kind of, it felt it ought to be.
And yeah.
Once you're competing with the others, it took some of that.
But you can also see why the distributor would say it's got to be every month, because for them it's very difficult to build a business if you're not every month. Because you can't say the retailer, it's coming every month, leave a space for it kind of thing. Mind you, those days are now gone, aren't they, for all of us? So this is if we're talking about the penny farthing, isn't it, really?
I have a do we have time for a quick anecdote?
Go on.
Yes.
Go on.
So I was in my local supermarket just twice a week, but it was about 2 weeks ago. And this supermarket is big enough that it has a magazine area and it has a magazine rack, as they often do at the what we call the checkout here. It's a decent set of magazines. I mean, there was a special on Nirvana right at the checkout. The magazine rack, I know, has some decent cooking magazines, because I've looked. And I heard from behind me this little kid say, "Dad, let's buy a magazine." And I looked around and it was quite a young, dare I say, trendy family, because the kid had an Italian football shirt on.
Right.
And Dad looked, you know, like some kind of 30-something, late 30s hipster. And he said, "No, son, people don't buy magazines anymore."
No!
Yeah.
No. Oh, that was a chilling.
What a strange thing to say to your child.
It is.
Because normally, if you have a child showing any interest in reading anything,
incredible. Well, have a chocolate bar instead. Yeah.
No, just to speak to your point, the kid said, people don't read magazines anymore, or don't buy them, one or the other. And the kid said, "Why not?" And he said, "Oh, the internet killed all of that." And what got me was that actually there was some semi-decent, it wasn't just National Enquirer. I mean, it was, you know, I was tempted by a Nirvana special. I'm like, well, what do they still say about Nirvana? It hasn't been said. Maybe I'll spend that $5 and not read it. But it was like, oh my God, you know,
that is a strange thing to say.
Yeah,
because actually, one of the few areas of the magazine market in Britain that I think is doing quite well is the small children's market.
Right.
Because parents like buying things for small children that encourage them to just sit there and read rather than stab at a tablet and so forth.
Yeah, maybe I just heard from the odd very odd hipster family. There must be a reason there are magazines in the supermarket. I mean, you would think that some of them have to sell.
But yeah, I'm sure that's the case. So this is obviously, this is the stocking filler, if people still have stockings.
Yeah.
For the people who really miss us jamming and the Beano annual, you can have the, you know, the memories of one in the shape of another, can't you?
That's, and it'll save you having to buy them on eBay, because I noticed there's, you know, issue 6 is for 46 quid. You can get that on eBay.
Wow.
She's amazing.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is it really? Oh, yeah, my gosh.
It's very flattering, isn't it?
Have you still got a garage full of them?
Well, I did have a garage full of them. Did you say garage and not garage? Well, that's very American of you.
Okay.
The Americans say garage, isn't it? Because this is the one I get really upset about.
Garage.
So, and you said garage, and some people say garage. Right, there's three ways. It's the American one that gets me.
Garage is Southern Counties, which is where I'm from.
Oh, there we go.
Garage is North.
Well, garage is musical.
Well, garage
is in Britain. You say garage when you mean the form of music,
right?
And I come from the north, and I say garage.
There we go. There we go.
Anyway.
I got us off track. I did have a certainly a lockup full of them for a while, but you know, emigration will do something to that. Quite a number of magazines eventually followed me to the States. There was a point where I actually got things shipped over, and then you just keep moving around. And there was a point I let a whole load of them go. It was number 10 in particular, which is weird because it's such a good issue. And I was surprised I still had many. And, you know, they're probably $20-$30 on eBay. But it's what are you going to do? The main thing is I have one copy or more of every issue, or we couldn't have put this book together. And I am tempted to wonder if anybody else held on to the first issue. It was so bad that people only bought it out of sympathy. Lawrence was a really tough kid. I mean, he really, really was. He had this hard rock background. His dad was a bouncer, like the head of that main security firm. So when Lawrence went around school on the last day of term at Christmas 1977 and said, here, buy a fanzine, most people bought one. Yes. And then I went home for Christmas, sold it to sort of uncles and aunts and anybody else that took pity on me. And I suspect everybody threw them out, and I guarded mine. Like, I didn't want anybody to see that first issue for you know, what must be, what was it now, 44 years. But as I write now, you know, you've got to start somewhere. So now I've put it out for the world to see. But
oh, the first issue is so brilliant. There's a cover line on it which says something like, this is rarer and cheaper than any 12-inch single, so buy it. It's just such a nice thing, just handwritten on the cover. Yeah, it's a great cover line.
My handwriting is probably better than the drawing I attempted above, isn't it?
But I think the next issue, one of the cover lines is win an album. So you've obviously just had to go out and buy an album. You know, win an album of your choice. I think it's so brilliant. Win an album.
That is such a good idea. I think you should make a film about it, actually, Tony. I think you make a very sweet film, actually. Has anybody ever made a film about a fanzine? Make a good film, wouldn't it?
It would.
I kind of think it would. And, you know, side plug, but several years back I had this memoir, Boy About Town, that sort of told my story, but only up to the age of 16, only up to what would have been issue 10. But it was really meant to be a sort of coming of age, and it's my sort of almost famous in terms of, you know, being in that scene when you're 13, 14, 15.
Yeah.
And I had so many people say to me, that's a movie. And I'm like,
it is.
Then get it made. You know, it's like, that's not what idea. I do. But
it's a good movie.
Because you can see the all the staff members, all the characters, all the different characters, you know, the punk with green hair, you know.
Well, they also teenagers against adversity. You know, people like that idea. Yeah. You know, whether it's a baseball team or a fanzine.
And every episode they've got to go, I was thinking of it a sitcom now. So every episode they've got to get an issue out. But
you've made it more complicated.
It's more complicated.
It's now a sitcom.
That's right. Yeah.
That's great. And as I keep saying to people, run with it. Run with it and let me know when you get the deal. I mean, I do agree with you, but God knows when you spend enough time, and listen, you know about this, when you spend enough time shopping book ideas and trying to get the things done that you do, the idea of like, oh, I think I'm now just going to go off and write a script or a movie and, you know, just take a plane to Hollywood or something and try and sell something. You hope that somebody will get in touch with you.
We'll put that idea out into the ether that somebody should make a movie based on the story of Tony Fletcher and Jammin, based on this book. And somebody, you never know, might be listening, and somebody might think that's a good idea. Tony, it's been lovely to talk to you.
Fantastic talking.
What are you working on at the moment? What else are you doing?
I've been trying to get this wrapped up for a little while, but the timing is really good coming out of this. There was always meant to be a sequel to that aforementioned Boy About Town, because everybody said, well, you're 16, you're about to start a record label with Paul Weller. What happens next? And I am very, very far through that. It's been a longer process than the initial one. Very, very far through that. And I do, I do have things, but funny enough, I'd actually work as a show director with kids here at the Rock Academy, actually sort of like the original sort of Rock Academy. And I have a lot of fun trying to, you know, get 13-year-old modern versions of me and 8-year-old versions of me and 17-year-old versions of me on stage at the same time, you know, playing the same song in the same key. And it's keeps me very young and very old at the same time. So
that's fantastic.
Fantastic. Yeah. What a great thing to do.
All good work, Tony.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.